the community and your father's interaction with the community.
Yeah. Now, let's see. Well, there I don't remember too many happenings. Lenox Avenue.
How did he go to shul every?
Did he go what?
Did he go to shul every week? And
I don't think he was religious. And he worked on a Saturday. Naturally, he smoked way back home
right.
there. So he smoked incessantly. He used to smoke these little Rosa cigarettes, the black, the dark cigarettes, Nicola Pack. And boy, did he smoke day and night, day and night, day and night. In fact, I heard him, somebody once asked him, Mr. Bloom, if somebody could assure you that you'd live 10 years long if you stopped smoking, would you? And he's thinking it over, he said no. Surely he was a goner, he smoked.
What year did he die?
He died, now let's get that. You have no mention there in any of your papers.
I think it's the 30s sometime.
30, it was 34, 38, now wait a minute. Oh, now let's see. Of course, it could be traced if it were absolutely necessary because Naomi and Ruth were born, had been born. In fact, I went to Atlantic City with them when he died. So what year? It was 34. It's the best I could think of now. But if necessary, we can get the exact date almost.
What did he die of, do you remember?
A heart condition. And that's a story in itself, as long as you ask him. He liked Pinochle. And at that time, I don't know whether he's retired or not. However, he used to play at Pinochle with some of his friends there at 116th Street and Lenox Avenue. On the other side of Lenox Avenue from where we lived on 119th Street, I believe. We lived on 119th Street. And he used to while away his time there playing Pinochle with his friend. And there he got his first heart attack. Must have had a bad one because he didn't know what to do. He went down, say he thought of it, if he could get home quickly. Now, if we wanted to go home fast, we'd think of a taxi, and he did. He called the taxi, and when he told the taxi driver he wants to go from 116th Street to 119th, they wouldn't take him. In those days, they wanted long hauls. So, one taxi passed another and another, and they wouldn't take him for the same reason, too short a trip. So finally, he walked home. After his first serious attack, he walked home from 116th Street to 119th Street, across the street. So he was all right, though. He came back, and another person might have killed him, but nevertheless, he lived through it. So when I asked him later on, after he got well, I said, you called the taxi man, you called another. They wouldn't go because of short distance. Why didn't you say to the fellow, look, I'll give you $5, take me these blocks, and they do it. He says, you know, you don't think of those things because you're not accustomed to taxis. See, you or I would do it in a minute because we know taxi is something that we've used to him. So he could have come out. However, that's the story he told us. So he got home. He lived a long time after, as far as I know.
Did he go to the doctor? Did he have a doctor?
He must have had it. No, I don't remember the doctor. I don't remember the doctor. No, I don't remember.
Did he die at home? Or?
Home? He didn't die at home. Yeah.
Was he living on the farm with
no.
you then in Norwood? Or?
No. When he died?
Yeah.
No. In fact, I went with your mother and Ruth when they were kids to Atlantic City the day he died. I had visited him before.
Was he in Atlantic City or?
No, he was in New York.
Okay, so you were saying you went down to Atlantic City.
So before we went to Atlantic City, I had seen him. I think the same day, and he didn't look so well. I said, well, maybe I won't go. He says, you go. I'm feeling fine. You know how sick people talk. Look at me. Oh, look what they did to me. So However, I did go because he assured me everything is all right. When we got there, we got the message that he died. So then we came back. So the date, no, wait a minute, I was 34. I'll put that down as pretty sure. So he died in 34. And that was that. Now, talking about the various enterprises that he took, he always, naturally, a delicatessen was on the ground floor, and there was always a basement underneath. That's the way they built those houses, basement underneath, and that was part of the store, or the storekeeper could keep his merchandise there. So, what he used to do, to make a few dollars, he'd whitewash the basement floor and take in what he could to sell. Now, once he had trunks, bags and trunks, foreign business to him all together, don't take bags and trunks. What do you want to do?
Keep going, I'm just... Keep talking.
Yeah. Bags and trunks, but he evidently made a few dollars on that. And at another time, he whitewashed one of his basements, and he sold what I remember they called passamentary. That was the trimmings for sofas that they had in those days, hanging trimming. So he went to that. But the main example I remember, he always had a way of trying to help himself out in a situation. He didn't give up. He had a delicatessen store up in the Bronx, 2615 Third Avenue. That's where I learned how to swim.
That was the first store.
No, well, it was before Lenox Avenue, because I went, wait a minute, I went to high school up there. No, it was, sure, I went to high school. I graduated from public school 24, that was in Manhattan, while we had the store on Lenox Avenue. 24, no, if I graduated in 1907, I graduated. We lived up there in the Bronx before that. Mm-hmm. So
when he first came to America,
yeah.
Where did he live?
Oh, way downtown. I don't even remember.
That was when you were...
I was just born down there.
Yeah, where did he live then, do you know?
Well, I don't know the exact. I know they talk about a Rivington Street. But he must have had a store on Rivington Street, which didn't impress itself on me. Because I was too young.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know too much of that area. The first area I began to know when it became more affluent, it went up to the richer places, you know, like 2nd Avenue and Lenox Avenue.
So after Riddington Street, he went, after that first one,
yeah,
he moved to...
As far as I know,
yeah.
If it's Riddington, it's 215, that's the uh-huh. number that remains in my mind. Yeah, then he started uptown, and he even got his brother, Barnett, interested, and he opened the store for himself, also delicatessen. What happened there, I don't know. But so what I want to bring out is, that which store was I talking about? In the Bronx. Were we
right.
up at the Bronx?
Where you're just trying to get the sequence. So the second store was in the Bronx, was that?
Oh, I don't know what it was. At first, I don't remember anything about that.
You don't remember anything about the
first except
store.
What I heard.
Right.
I was too young. Because at the second store, the 1621, that's the time he took me to Staten Island. Right?
Right.
So I was about 7 or so.
Right.
So that was the second, and then he went to the...
Where was that one? The second one?
It's 1620.
That was...
As far as I know...
On Lenox Avenue.
1621, no.
The 2nd Avenue.
2nd Avenue.
Right.
1621, I was a kid then. 1621. Then, I told you, he took a store on the other side to keep competition away. Then he must have gone to the Bronx. Where I went to school there, must have been public school, PS 39, I think, I'm not sure. However, I went to school there, and then he moved to Lenox Avenue, and that's where I started with Public School 24, where that teacher of mine still owes me a silver medal. I probably told you that story.
Good. Tell it again.
Well, I was evidently good in mathematics, and he was a math teacher, and everything was going along fine. So right before graduation, which would have been in June, he promised me a silver medal. Oh, boy. When I went home and told him I'm going to get a silver medal, all right, well, smart boy, I guess. So, however, I was waiting for that time. So right before graduation, a few days before, some kid, they had what they called putty blowers in those days. They bought them for a penny or two, and they didn't have putty, but they take a piece of newspaper, shoot it, get it good and wet, put it in their mouth, and take a name at somebody, whomever they could, for the fun of it, you know. And boy, he gets shot with paper and spit. So he had his back to us. He was showing an example on the board. And some kid decided, boy, nice bald spot back there. And he aimed right, got the paper wet, and boy, you could see that thing splashing on the back of his head. So he turns around. Who the hell knows who did it? Kids don't tackle. So he picks me up. He says, you. Me? Gee, I'm waiting for that silver medal. I wouldn't do a thing like that. First of all, I wouldn't do it. And secondly, he says, no. He knew what he was about. He says, you didn't do it. Well, then who did it? See, he was waiting for me to talk. I didn't know. I really didn't know. But even if I knew, I couldn't think of a medal. I'd be killed there by the kids. That's all you have to do. So I said, I don't know. And at that moment, he says, I withdraw my offer for the medal. Oh, boy, did I feel terrible. But that's the way. Later on, I was going to write him. He was still alive, but too late. So that was that. And that reminds me of a story where evidently I must have been a good math student because it must have been a city college, because that's the only high school I had there, Townsend Harris Hall. We used to do geometric problems and the theorems. And they were nothing to me, and do them at night. In fact, in the daytime, the boys, knowing that I was good and bring the answers in, they all copied my answers. We'd get into the stairway well where nobody would see us, and they all copied my answers. So he had a class of smart boys. So that's that. Now, the reason I bring that in is that I went through one theorem, and I forget now, I did it in four steps, we say. And I could do it in three. I went through, and I thought that was pretty good. So I went in that day when we were talking about that theorem, and I said, half afraid to tell a teacher, you know, we looked up, we respect the teachers. So I said, I worked that out at home. I can do it in three steps instead of four. So this son of a gun, instead of patting you on the back, well, let's hear. He talks to the class. Here's a young man. They've been doing this thing for 2,000 years or something, and he's going to show us a different way. You know, not the teacher-like. But knowing your stuff and being sure, I said, well, I did it. He said, maybe you'd like to show it to the class. Oh, boy, what a sinking feeling. Suppose I am wrong. So I went to the blackboard, and there I showed this. You can eliminate this, and there you got the answer. All he said is, I guess you're right. Take your seat, like that. Instead of really getting a kid who seemed to be smart, pat him on the back, he might do something. Oh, no. I'd like to get that book, that geometry book, and see which one is wise.
Do you remember what it was about? Or?
Well, it was, see, what it was about, it couldn't have been a very intricate one because it was only four or five steps, I remember. But I eliminated one, whichever way, in a mathematical way. And, I could, if I had the book, I have an idea, it's on the left-hand page on top. Well,
you remember the name of the book?
I guess one could easily find out if one wanted to, you know, from what book they used for geometry then. I was only there a year.
So this was at City College?
City College, must have been, because where do we get geometry? When do you start?
Was it in the City College, or was it in your year of high school before?
Well, City College was the high school.
Right, that, yeah.
The first year was Townsend Harris Hall.
Right.
That was considered high school. But if you
how many years did you go to Townsend Harris?
1 year.
1 year.
But then, with the whether college was 3 years, then I don't know. But you'd save a year because that was a combined class for special students. So, however, that's my story. But now let's see. I was coming to a story about my father there. Which store was we at last? Well, the Bronx. I remember that. So he opened this store, delicatessen, and supposed to be kosher on our business. So things weren't going well at one time. So let's see where
so
we
are. So you're saying it was supposed to be kosher and
well,
the delicatessen in the Bronx?
Yeah, delicatessen.
Right.
He had a kosher on the window and all that business. So things weren't going so well. So he thought if you had a Jewish butcher in the neighborhood, that would attract people because people wanted kosher meat, etc. So to bring more Jewish people in the neighborhood, so you can do a little more business. He decided if they had a Jewish butcher in that neighborhood. So he found right? So there was an empty store across the avenue there. And he put an ad in the paper, Jewish paper, I suppose, wanted a Jewish butcher, will subsidize, etc. So he got a hold of a fellow who was a butcher, and he bought the necessary tables and whatever is necessary, and he put this fellow in the business selling meat, all on his own, but my father put the money in. So it evidently didn't go too well at the butcher business, so what he did, he took delicatessen and groceries, and then my father wanted somebody to bring more people and to buy from him, so he took away a lot of business from my father. So instead of getting more business, subsidizing this guy, he had less. So he decided he's got to do something. He was a fighting man when it came to that. So he had the basement, whitewashed it, and took in meat. A regular Macy Gimbel business. He took in meat and sold it cheaper than that guy.
Mm-hmm.
So people who did buy this kosher meat, they bought from him. He hired a butcher down there, and he drove the other fellow out of business, the other fellow he set up. So then he was satisfied. So then when the other fellow went away, he had an empty basement. So he figured, what can he do? It was whitewashed already. I don't know what they paid for whitewash in those days, but evidently it was a cheap thing. So he decided it's all clean for a new business. A lot of poor people in the neighborhood, and for that reason, there were a lot of shoemakers in the neighborhood, because poorer people don't buy new shoes. So that is so often. So there are a lot of stores, shoemakers. So he took in leather and findings. The findings refer to the tacks, nails, whatever they use, heel plates, etc. So he didn't know anything about leather, how to cut it. But I was about 10 years old and I used to watch. He hired a man who was in that leather business and he showed him how to take a whole hide and cut it up. And in the good parts, you'd have it for soles and heels. The wrinkled part near the neck, you'd use that for fillers in. Then you had to divide it with a piece of chalk and put the price on each one. And I used to watch, and after that, I used to cut them. I don't know how I watched this guy once or twice, and mark it, how much it was worth, etc. So he did a little business then with the shoemakers there, which shows that he never stood still. He always went to help himself and help the family, of course. So that was that. Any more incidents along that line? Well, he had the leather passementry, the eggs.
Would they? Why would they whitewash the basement before?
Well, because usually the buildings there, I guess, were built in ordinary concrete, the substructure, and it just needed a little cleaning up.
Mm-hmm.
So to go and put in fancy work, it didn't pay for these products. So they whitewashed it. they do it on the basement, so it's clean looking, I guess, and cheap. So that was that. Now we got through with that. Let's see. Up in the Bronx, 26th.
End of recording on Saturday, May 4th, 1985. Next session, Sunday, May 5th, 1985.
I was in Europe again, and especially to visit Gunyan's. At the time, my father gave me a list of all the friends and said I should talk to them. And, all right, so I went to one house, this fellow's house. This fellow was the one I told you about. And he wanted to put me up because he had been in America. He had come there a few years before, and I remember him because he had red hair. But he liked the old country. Well, you know, people, they don't want to come unless they're sure. And he had his whole family there, so he came on a visit, you might say. So he left. Then later on, his whole family was decimated by the Nazis. And except for one or two sons who escaped to Israel. That's what I was told. So I came out there, and I had to visit everybody. And my father told me that he's an important person in his life, my father's life, and if I do anything for anybody, I should do it for him. So when I got there, he offered me a room. So the first thing, I wanted to wash my hands. Oh, God, that towel, it must have been white once. Gray, everybody using the same one towel. I just couldn't, you know, you just can't do certain things any more than I could eat in his house. You just can't. So I used some excuse. I said, well, I spoke to somebody here, and they were all anxious to have me there because that meant they'd leave a little money, more money for them. Because they knew that if you came over, you had money. And to them, no matter how much you give them, it'll be something. So I gave them first of all, I couldn't wipe my hands on that. So I used my handkerchief, much cleaner than that, and I wiped my hands with that. And I don't know how I got out of it, but I knew I couldn't sleep there. So there's a woman there who had a house nearby. They were all anxious to have me, those who had room for me. And I thought, all right, so whatever it is, I came, she showed me a room right on the ground floor. And that's, I think, the whole house was one floor. So, and I had read in the paper there that day that a couple of fellows who came from America with money for a certain little town, they had their throats slashed and the money taken away from them, and that was the end. So maybe I was the next victim, I thought. She put me in this room with the windows on the ground floor. Well, I quit one on account of unsanitary conditions. This one looked all right. So I went to bed, but I closed the windows, usually like a little fresh air, closed them tight, and I don't know whether I slept much that night. So I stayed at her house, as far as I remember. So, okay. Then they all flocked around me in Gunyan's, because that meant you'd slip a few dollars when you left. So they knew it. And after I was there a while, another day or two, I forget how long, I decided to go home. When they heard I'm going home, there was a lineup. You saw that picture. Lineup, I think right in front of this fellow's house. So I had to figure out, this one gets five, what do you call them, one of the Russian rubles. This one gets 3, 4, 5, etc. I come to one man, and I took pictures of them. Oh, no, forget the pictures. So then there was a lineup. So I started figuring how much to give this one. 3 rubles, 5 rubles, etc. And as I was about a quarter through the line, a man comes up to me, one that I had seen. He wouldn't let me take his picture because a religious pious Jew never has his picture taken. He shouldn't have graven images and all that business. But when he saw the lineup, he broke down a little, and he comes over to me. He sees me taking pictures. He said, all right, you can take a picture of me now. So, So I took a picture of him and he got in line. So what was this? I gave one, 3, 5, 7, 4, I said whatever I thought. No, after I was through with them, I went to this fellow, the one with the red hair, right? And I told, and my father told me if I could do anything, do it for him. So he gave me a story. His top floor is leaking and he really should put a second floor on because they have trouble there. So I said, all right, I'll help you. Gave him $300. That was like
$300.
Well, my father said, treat him right, and I had the money. So I gave him $300. With the others, I gave $5, $10 at the most, as far as I remember. And that whole lineup, each one got something, including the man who wouldn't allow his picture to be taken. So gave him the $300, and then I ready to depart. So, all right, so that's finished. He had his $300, and I was slated for France, and then England, and then home. So while I was there, one girl, she was going to get married, and she said, that's a good reason for giving her more. I said, all right, you're getting married, and I was sorry for her. I said, I'll give you $25. Oh, no, she says, $25, you can't get married on $25. She kept at me, until I had to leave Gunyan's. And from Gunyan's, I had to take a four, one of these taxi, not a cab, but a little rig and a horse, polycolor, I think it's called. And he was arranging to take me to Bialystok, where I can get the train wherever I had to go. And she was pestering me the day before, and that day I said, take the 25 because I haven't got more. She won't get married unless she gets 50. So when I took the little, what do you call them, the little taxi or whatever it was, horse and carriage, she was there. She wanted to show she's the good sport. She'll say goodbye, and I was the dog. So just as soon as I get in the taxi, I said, you can still have the $25. No, 50 or nothing. So what did she do? She knew her business. So as soon as the taxi, that's like a misnomer. So as soon as the taxi left, she says, well, I'll go along. I want to be with you until you get, she wants to be with me. She's doing all the favors. So we got to Bialystok, and I arranged, I must have had tickets or arranged for tickets. She was following me. And we got to the railroad station. I was ready to go. And then we heard the train whistle, making a curve around someplace. She saw it'd be too late because she says, all right, now I'll take the 25. But you had to be sorry for them because everybody was poor, but so poor. Whether she got married or not, I don't know, but that was a good excuse. So that's the way it was there. So I got out. Let's see, was there anything else in Gunyan's? Well, What they have there, they probably have it in all countries at that time. They have the a day when they fair or whatever they buy and sell merchandise, and people come and sell animals. So the way they sell it is a man brings in, we'll say, a cow, and he wants to sell it, and he's got to buy a now. So he says to the man who sold the buyer, said, well, how much you want for it? Well, I'll just make up the amounts because you see how this whole thing ends up. He said, I want $75, the rubles. The other one, he naturally won't give him his first bid, so he wants to make a very low bid so they can get together. But he has a right to have the seller put his hand out and give him a punch, but a real punch to break him down. That's just that's the way they did it. So the seller was saying 75. He gets he and one of those guys, they have fists like that. Bam, oh boy. Then, well, he got his punch and he wouldn't take the other fellow probably off, say 30 or 40. He said, well, how much now? So he came down. He came down to 65 and then the other one, but each time, then he punched the buyer. And he punched. till they got down to a place where they decided. So that's there. Now, there was a fellow who owned the ferry boat. But who mentioned, somebody mentioned the ferry boat. A few planks put together, enough to hold 10 or 15 people, big heavy planks. A rope thrown across the Bubber, was the name of the little stream, and a rope thrown this way. And he had an attendant who, when he was ready to go, he didn't have to whistle or anything, go like that, and the fellow would pull the ferry in on that side. And then when the ferry would fill up the other way. So I watched that. He took me for the ride. It was two copecks a ride, 2 pennies, 2 cents. So they all lined up on the ferry boat, and two big poles, like wooden Indians. They don't, he went around with his cup to come. They don't pay. So, we got it off, and they walked off, free ride. So later on, I asked him, how come these two? He said, look, they don't want to pay. You just pass them by, because if you insist, they'll throw you in the river, and they'll ferry themselves across all along. So that's the way they lived. He was the ferryman. Well, that's about all the highlights that I remember of Gunyan's. Let's see, anything else happened there?
What year was that?
It must have been, I see, I have to get the year. I went to Europe with my sister Sarah and Irving Grossman. Grossman was from the Grossman family. You may not know him. They ran. Do they still operate in Lakewood? So, however, she married one of the Grossman sons, and they went there. And then I went with them. At the time, I went with them, and then we separated. They went one way, and I went another way. And there, I visited Poland. What year, if it's ever important, I can always find out when Sarah got married. They're both dead. Everybody's dead. So, however, all right. Now, let's see. So, that's the time I visited Poland. Second time. Conditions there, how people lived there. Well,
1920s, maybe?
Oh, no, 1923, I was with the children. In fact, I have moving pictures of them here. But I didn't get a chance to get them. Very interesting. Kids, your mother was 1920.
Three.
How much?
Three,
and Ruth was 5. We almost lost her because we were walking around and we came out of a store, and there were canals all over in Holland. And this was in Amsterdam. And all of a sudden, we see, where's Naomi? Oh boy, there, you know, flop right into the water. I thought I was watching, and your mother thought she, or whatever it was, we were looking for. She wasn't in the store, and she wasn't anywhere. Finally, somebody brought her up from around the corner, child walking around. She fell out the windows, and so she, her life was saved. So that's that. Heard a lot of stories in the sea in Holland. In fact, here's a date that we can probably work out. Because when I was in Holland, Rudolf Diamond, I don't know where that name comes in here, he was father of Lincoln and Philip. So I visited him. His uncle, that would be Philip's uncle, yeah, because the one who was here was Rudolf Diamond, and he had died. He died just before I left. So I visited the brother there. What was his name? Can't think of the moment. However, he showed me the place where the Nazis took these people and put them on boats. So it must have been about the 40s, right? Or around that. So that date can be pinpointed if necessary. So he showed me, here's the place where they gathered all the people, put them on boats, sent them to Germany, wherever he sent them. So that was the incident there. His whole family went to. And one daughter became a nun probably whatever they did to her, you know. So to save her own soul, you might say, she joined the church and became a nun.
How did he escape?
Huh?
How did he escape?
Huh?
The man that you were with.
Oh, well, I suppose a few were left. They didn't take them all. But all the others that I had seen, his cousins, all gone. He was left alone. As far as I know, he didn't have a wife or children, no. Well, that's the way it was. So I saw the place where the Nazis took them all. So that was that. And then, there's a sequel to the story where I gave the fellow the $300. Then I went to France and England quick, and then I came back. So when I came back, my father said he got a letter from this fellow, the one, the redhead, whom I gave $300 to. And he says, I ruined him in the letter. I ruined him, I gave him $300. He said he got the structure built, the second floor that he needed, but there was no money left out of the $300 to put the roof on. And now it's worse than ever. Before it only leaked in. Now, so what are you going to do? In America, we send them a few dollars to put a roof on. So that was the end of that. But my father said, ruined. He said, you ruined. So, and you know, strange, you see, he wanted to go back. My father's younger brother was Bonnet, we used to call him. And he came with his family, but he was always yearning to go back to Gunyan's. Well, you know, place where you live for a long time, but he never went back.
So this trip must have been in the one where you went to France and England afterwards was in 23.
That's the first trip.
Right. And the trip where you referred to the Nazis?
That's the second one must have been around the war time, and before the war,
just before the war?
Probably, because after the war, everybody was free, more or less.
But which trip did you give the money to everybody? That was when you were a bachelor, right? Weren't you a bachelor?
Was I what?
A bachelor, when you went to Europe and gave the money to all the people.
No, I was...
No, you had...
No, because... No, I had time. That's why I wanted to visit again, but as long as my sister Sarah got married to this Grossman, I took advantage of it and went along, but their interests were different and they stopped and I went to Poland and all that. Incidentally, from Poland I had to send a telegram, which cost $5 to some place, probably to them. Never was sent, nothing.
So the time you went to Gunyitz and gave them the money,
that was
the second trip?
That was the second trip.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, just before.
It must have been the second trip because I wouldn't have taken the children there anyway in the first trip. I was alone. And,
Okay.
Now wait.
Okay, correct version.
Now wait, what do you want to get me?
You went alone. 1923, you went alone.
It seems I went alone, but my wife, Kate, I think decided to come with the kids anyway, with the kids, your mother and Ruth. And that's right. And took a boat, let me know that they're coming. That's all. So then they met me there.
After Gunyitz, after you had been in Gunyitz.
Must have been. Oh, yeah. They surely
were. So there was only one trip.
Wait a minute, after I've been in Gunyitz. I can clear that up. I have a letter of credit that I never turned in. There was a dollar left on it. I thought I'd keep it for a souvenir. And that gives the date.
Okay.
And
so, which you said is...
That's a little unclear. I know Heave Solomon, that's the one. He showed me the pier where the Nazis...
Right, so, but that was in the 1960s.
And you were there?
Because I was there. I mean, I was in Amsterdam with you and Solomon and Mom and Dad, so it must have been in 65 or 66.
Mom and Dad, and I was there.
Yeah. I mean, I know that we went then, so that may be where you remember the thing about the pier with the Nazis. I mean, I think that must have been in the 60s.
Well, it must have been. Yeah. It couldn't have been. That's right.
Right, obviously.
So I went three times. Well, thanks for the third trip.
Don't mention that.
Gee. Well, I can clear that up. I can look at that.
Okay.
A letter of credit I took. So it must have been three times. Wait a minute.
Okay. How about Kate's family, Grandma Kate's family?
Kate's family, I know very little. You have the picture. The only one who can give you information on is Harold.
Right.
He's the last one. Right. He may have a lot of pictures. Then we can refresh ourselves with that. He'd be glad to work in if you tell him what you do.
Do you remember Kate's parents?
Oh, why, sure. He was here, and they. In fact, Minnie was married in their house on Lenox Avenue. They also lived there. They lived right up, not also. We lived near Lenox Avenue. So, sure. When I met them, they already had nine children. So he came over, or it must have been later he came over. Was it? I don't know. However, but I don't know too much about them. What would you want to know about them, person?
Anything you remember about where they lived?
They lived on 163 Lenox Avenue. I remember that. Mm-hmm. And that's where Min and Sam Yarbrough were married. I have pictures of that.
What did Max Rosen do?
Max Rosen worked in the factory. He never went out in for himself. He was in the ironing department, whatever, they gave him various jobs.
Which factor?
Huh?
Which factory?
With what?
Which factor?
No, in the factory where they made clothes, men's clothes, probably new clothes, and he did the ironing when it finished. So he never had any other job as far as I know. Now, of course, he had nine children. Louis was a lawyer. He became the head of the law department in Albany one time. So he was all right. I'm going down the line. Who was next to Louis? I don't know the ages, you know, my own family. I know it. But however, there was Minnie, and she married this Yarbrough. And he used to make pocketbooks, ladies' pocketbooks. And then he went to South America, where it was cheap to make them. And he made them there, and then made some money. I don't know, he sold them. And the irony of the whole thing was, when he left, he said, "Now, I'm going to South America now," where it was known that you'd make some money. And he says, "I'll make enough money and come and live on the front of the land," meaning when he came. Shows you how we know. He came a short time later, he was driving his car, and he got a heart attack in the car. But evidently he sensed it coming because he drove over to the curb and there he died.
Oh.
So he probably wasn't fatal at that moment. So there, and then we had of course, Kate, you know, she's your grandmother, right? So Kate, they all had the quality of a musical quality that I'd say our family, the Bloom family, did. We liked things and such, but there was always a little music there and singing and such. Kate, my wife, she could sing. She had a good voice and could sing. And the others, one would play an instrument, one would do this. They all did something. So let's see. And a sense of humor ran through that family that we didn't have now. We were more of a serious kind, as you know, our family. But they were always joking about things. And you see now we go down the line, they had nine kids. They had one, they're all gone. Harold is the last. Then I told you about, she had to say in case she had a little money, because he did leave her money, he made money down there. And she went down to I think Florida for a rest. She came back, something happened to her mind. And she didn't recognize her best friend. And then from then on, she went to the hospital and died. So that's many. Then we had Norman. Norman. Norman became a dentist. And he died of Parkinson's disease, poor guy. So that was that. Norman. Estelle, I mentioned, that was the other sister. Did I mention her? Estelle. No, well, I mentioned Minnie. Estelle was the other one. Estelle, she married Carl's brother-in-law. That's right. He was a brother Carl's father was, let me get the name straight.
Roscoe?
Who?
Roscoe?
Right. No, that's the one Estelle married. So she married this Roscoe. He had worked in the stamp department, in the printing department. He didn't do the printing, but he had some other work. And he used to collect stamps. So when he died too, he left her quite a little bundle of good stamps. Too bad he had access where he could buy good stamps, but however. So that was that. Who else now? We got going up the line. Still. Then we had Irving. Irving, he never had any regular trade. He used to float from job to job. But he was a henpecked, oh boy, talk about henpecked husbands. Well, she gave it to him. So she always seen that he was busy on a job, because she didn't care what job he got. He worked in a place where they did tinning and soldering and all and everything, and he had to do everything that she wanted. She was the boss. So what happened to him? He got a stroke, I think, and then he went. Now let's see how many we got there, about four or five, we got a few more. Herman, I laugh when I think of it, and so him. He was all right, he had a head on his shoulder, but he also floated around until he got in the beauty parlors of business. And then he went in business for himself, because he saw what it was, and I guess he made a few dollars. So when he was in business himself, he comes in here once, to the house, and he said, I want you to help me out, Dave. I said, well, what is it? And I look at his nails. One is red, purple, all different colors. He was experimenting with something. He said, I have an idea of a little machine, electric, the girls can put their hands in and bake the stuff I put on. Be a good idea. I don't know whether it wouldn't break their fingers. So we tried it in a toaster, some sort of a place where he could, and he was satisfied. So I said, you can get a patent on it. So we're here. So I wrote out something. He got a patent sheet I bought. You can buy them, the patent sheets. And I was pretty good at drawing these things, and I drew a machine with the hands in. So he had to go to business. He was working in the meantime while his patent and his pending never came across. Of course, they threw that back. You have to have a patent according to certain standard. So he used to go around the subways and everybody looked at him, all different colors. But he was trying. He says it works. Then he died of a heart condition.
He may have been the very first new wave person.
Yeah. So he died. Yeah, as I told you before, I used to take orders out on Lenox Avenue. And I got up early with my father about 4 o'clock in the morning to get ready for the orders, which I did. But about 8 or 9, my father shooed me home, go home, but I wanted to stay and watch some play Pinochle and whatnot. So one night, having to stay too late, and he said, you got to go home now. I'll come home soon. So it must have been very late, about 11 or 12 o'clock. And I got home. We lived nearby. And I guess I was tired, and I started undressing. And that's all. So he came in about an hour later. And I only had taken one shoe and one stocking off and fell asleep on the bed. So he came in. He said, what are you doing here? He saw I was. He said, go back. So he went to his room. But I took a look at myself. I didn't know that I had come from the store. I figured I'm getting ready for the orders. So I put on the stocking, put on the clothes that I had, and I had to go through his room. We had a railroad flat in those days. He says, where are you going? I said, we were for the orders. He says, go back to bed, get schlafen, and you fell asleep with one stocking on. So that's the story there. All right, well, I'll think of a few more stories or whatever I think is interesting.